couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. I am PO'd this week. I am so mad about this nonsense happening in Hollywood. I'm not talking about bad movies or good movies being made. I'm talking about movies that are being not seen because of foreign dictatorships. And we will talk about that at length today because we are living in North Korea right now, apparently. But we're also going to be talking about the movies that have released this week. That includes The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies, Night at the Museum, Secret of the Tomb, and Annie. There's also going to be other news, very briefly, the trailer park, some box office predictions, and the DVD roundup. Of course, like I said, I've got plenty to say about the Sony hack and the insane decisions made to axe the interview completely from the slate. But before we talk about that, this is how you can get in touch with me. If you want to email me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. If you want to find me on the internet, you can find me at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach me on Twitter, twitter.com/KevinCarr, but just don't get on Twitter and just start arguing me with nonsense. I've had people get on and talk absolutely bonkers nonsense that's contradictory to what they've just said. Don't do that, because I'm going to block you. If you want to have a reasonable discussion, yes, Twitter is fine. Otherwise, get out.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
There's a lot going on in the news, but there's really only one thing that I'm going to be talking about today. I can mention Beetlejuice 2's happening with Tim Burton, Winona Ryder, and Michael Keaton. That's going to happen. She's going to be 45 when she makes this movie, but whatever. Pirates of the Caribbean's getting rebooted with Orlando Bloom. J.K. Simmons and Tom Hiddleston are going to be in Kong, the sequel to King Kong, Skull Island. But the big news that happened this week is Sony wussed out completely and canceled the interview, not just the screenings, not just a Christmas Day release. They have completely scrapped it from all platforms, theatrical, VOD, DVD, what have you. At least right now, that's what they're saying. I mean, there's more to that later. We'll talk about that. But not only that, when some independent theater said, well, if we can't show the interview, let's show Team America World Police. Because that, of course, makes fun of dictator Kim Jong-il, who was, of course, Kim Jong-un's father, who was made 10 years ago. Paramount came in and axed that. Completely said, no, you can't show that either, which is insane. If you don't know the background, The Interview is a movie where Seth Rogen and James Franco play two guys who go and pretend to interview Kim Jong-un, and then they try to assassinate him. And for the last 6 months or so, the North Koreans have been stomping their feet and saying how disrespectful it is. They started to make threats, and then they hacked into, supposedly, at least from what we know, it is likely that North Korea hacked into Sony's computer systems, wiped out their system, and just released a dump of information out. And then they wrote this really completely broken English threat of 9/11 style attacks on movie, any movie theater showing The Interview. It was slated to go into like 3,000 theaters. And Sony said, okay, you don't have to show a movie if you don't want to. And then all these theaters canceled, and then Sony canceled the release of the film completely. And now Paramount has completely pulled Team America, a 10-year-old movie being shown publicly. This sets a terrible precedent, and it lays a blueprint for any movie to be canceled at any time. Foreign government or not, apparently all you have to do is make a threat, and that movie is going to be pulled completely. It doesn't even have to be a good threat, because it was vetted by Homeland Security, and they said it wasn't credible, yet they still did this. Look, I was in Jerusalem this summer. Went to Jerusalem, Israel, and I saw a bunch of movies about Israeli-Arab relations while missiles were literally being fired at us from 50 miles away. The sirens were going off. I was in a war zone, and they would still have this festival going. They had some security issues that they had to reschedule some things, but I still saw it. Now, a lot of people have said this is not a free speech issue, and technically it's not. It's not a constitutional free speech because our government's not having anything to do with this. The Constitution guarantees that the government won't hamper free speech. This is even worse. This is a foreign dictatorship censoring, not allowing people to see a movie. They've gotten so huge with this, they're not even going to let people see it, which is absurd. And it sets a terrible precedent. This is a foreign government censoring a movie within our borders. And the reason this becomes a bigger issue is, can you imagine, a friend of mine, Amy Nicholson, wrote an article about this, and she made a point. What movies are going to be killed at the pitch stage because of this now? This isn't just about one movie. This is about everything that comes after it. What movie are studios now not going to greenlight because the North Koreans might get upset at this? Or anybody might get upset at this? That's terrible. That cripples free speech, though through our government, but it doesn't make it okay that it's not happening through the government. And people need to stop calling these people terrorists, because they're not. They're hackers. Calling them terrorists is like calling somebody who buys a lotto ticket a millionaire. Not only had they not done anything violent, all they did was an information dump, which was damaging and very hurtful and serious problems for a lot of people, but it wasn't a direct violent thing to do. That's all they did. You don't even know if these people are in the States. They're probably not. They've shown no reasoning that they can actually conduct any sort of attack. So blind, crazy, boisterous threats that have been made dozens of times before by dictators, and in particular North Korea, somehow this is being taken seriously? Even though Homeland Security said no? Now here's the thing. Sony canceling the interview was going to happen once the theater said they weren't going to show it, because you can't have a theatrical release without showing the movie. I think what they should do is they should put it online. Put it as VOD. You'll completely neuter the issue, because now what are they going to do? Say, if anyone downloads it, we're going to attack you? How? Put it on like Amazon or Netflix. Get it out there. But, you know, we've seen in the past when Comedy Central pulled their own programming because of radical Islamic threats about them showing Muhammad. This is a bad precedent. This is the second step we've seen happen in this. And that's a bad thing. More on this later. I'm going to talk about this in the next segment. But right now, I have to move on. Listening to Fat Guys of the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means we got to roll into the trailer park really quick. The first movie I want to hit is Knight of Cups. This is the new Terrence Malick film. Now, people who know me know I think Terrence Malick is a pretentious windbag. I can't stand his movies. I find them boring. I find them at times nauseating. I find them stupid, and I find them poorly put together. But here is the trailer for the new movie.
Let me tell you about you. I want to make you rich.
You see the palm trees? They tell you anything's possible.
No one cares about reality anymore.
Different these days. What's going on with you?
I can't remember a man I wanted to be.
It looks and sounds and feels exactly like a Terrence Malick movie. This visual poetry, this whoopy, slurpy look at the world. People who love Terrence Malick are going bonkers over this. To me, this looks like To the Wonder, which was one of his more recent films, just done again with maybe a little more locations. Terrence Malick fans are going to love it. I think this is going to be terrible. It opens sometime in 2015. They don't even have a full release date set. The other movie I want to hit really quick is Insurgent. I know we just played the teaser for that a couple weeks ago, but the full trailer's out, and let's see what that sounds like.
What does Janine think is in that box, Caleb?
I don't know. But she's testing divergence. Searching for the one who can open it.
Find them. Every last one of them.
Janine's never gonna stop coming after us. It's time we fight back.
We don't have the numbers.
We will.
This one is interesting because I did not like Divergent. I thought Divergent was not well done. I thought it was stupid, and I thought it was dumb, and I thought it was derivative. This one actually looks like there's something going on in it. This actually looks like there might be a little bit of action to it. There might be something going on beyond just this girl moping around about her uniqueness and ripping off every other teen movie that we've seen. I have a sinking suspicion that the really cool stuff's all in the trailer, and then the rest of the movie's going to be moping and whining and love triangles and nonsense like that, and poorly written teen drama. I've heard people who've read the book say that there's a lot of angst in this movie. Definitely more than Hunger Games. Not as much as Twilight, but then again, that's just wall-to-wall angst. Anyways, Insurgent, which I'm now somewhat curious to see, opens on March 20th. I need to go to a break. When we come back in the next segment, I'm going to be talking about the Sony hack in particular and a little bit more about the cancellation of The Interview.
Open Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style. Open Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style.
welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr, riding the white horse of freedom. Still on the radio, where you can actually have a certain level of free speech, and you can say stuff like Kim Jong-un is a complete blithering idiot, or the fact that he should be kicked in the nads. I'm allowed to say that. Sony Pictures has not crippled me from saying that yet. And the foreign government hasn't crippled me from saying that. Let's talk a little bit more about this. The Sony hack, this is where it really all got real. And why it's so threatening. It's not just the fact that Sony was hacked and all this data and information was stolen and then released. The media, of which I am part, who was complacent in delivering all this information to people. These were not the Pentagon papers. These were just internal documents, emails and balance sheets and stuff like that. It's the people who wrote about it like it was news and the people who gobbled it up. If you sat there linking out stories about how hilarious Channing Tatum's emails were and how wouldn't it be cool if he and Jonah Hill did this movie or that movie, you're part of the problem. I know I reported on a couple of these things, and if I could go back, I would change that, because in retrospect, it was wrong. But even then, these are like sort of like some minor news came out of this, like the whole thing of Sony and Disney working together to get Spider-Man back into the Avengers. That at least represents news, but most of the stuff was things that we either already knew, that there's a gender discrepancy in wages at Sony, or that Scott Rudin is a jerk. Who doesn't know that? I know several people in the industry, and they will all say, it's not a big surprise that Scott Rudin is a jerk. And the rest of it is just, God, it's gossip, it's nonsense, it's not news, most of it's not news at all. And the reality is with the Sony hack, real people were injured, not just the a-hole executives. There are people whose social security number and private info was released, and I'm talking about just regular old people who are working to make a living. The biggest crime was that they took a job at Sony Pictures. And they are now going to be chasing credit checks for the rest of their lives because their social security number and bank account information is out. These are the real victims here. And to sit there and say, oh, well, I think it's just so funny. I love all this news. I think it's great. You're part of the problem. So the entertainment press and the people reading it, all you people out there who just linked it out and shared it on Facebook, you were part of the problem. Why? Because this ramped it up. This caused a real problem for Sony. Not only did they lose their servers and they lost all this data and it's going to cost them, I've heard, over $100 million to get everything fixed and right. There's a group of people, the media and the public, who ramped this up to a fervor. So Sony was running scared. And I've heard people say, oh, well, they're just a whole bunch of mouth breather idiots over there at Sony. I'm okay with that. This is a bad precedent to set as well. To say it's okay to happen to them because they're jerks does not wash. There's a running theme with this, and we're going to hit this again in a minute. This is Kevin Carr here on Fat Guys in the Movies talking about Sony and the hack and the interview and why this was a bad thing for Hollywood and for the nation and our own culture in general. Here is why it happened and why it happened the way it did. Follow the money. Always follow the money. A lot of people are enraged about art and satire and this and that. Follow the money. Sony doesn't care about lives, first of all. All these decisions, people, oh, well, they're doing it to save lives. Sony doesn't care about the lives. Sony cares about the bottom line. People in Sony care, but Sony as a person, Sony as a corporate, rights-given, court-ruled, citizen-united, determined person doesn't care about people. Sony, the corporation, has no conscience. Sony, the corporation, cares only about its corporate bottom line. The people in Sony may care, and they do. But Sony itself, as a company, doesn't care. They care about money, and that's important because this was a huge economic attack on a huge corporation and a huge industry. Their government's looking into this. They are. But these decisions were made for money reasons and money reasons alone. Here's the timeline, in my opinion. Sony wigged out over the hack. The corporate person wigged out. Then they got this goofy threat, reported heavily by the news, as was done with everything with the Sony hack. And then Sony wanted out immediately for liability issues. Sony didn't want a gas main blowing up accidentally and causing any injury because they were going to get sued. And that's what they were worried about. So what they did is they said to the theaters, well, if you don't want to show the movie, you don't have to. We're not going to fine you for agreeing to show the movie and then not. And that was enough to give the corporations that run all of these companies like AMC and Regal and Carmike to say, okay, well, we're out. Well, like I said, you can't release a movie theatrically without theaters showing it. So when the theaters opted out, that forced Sony's hand, which Sony orchestrated. Sony, the corporation, is not the innocent victim. in this. Sony can put the entirety of the film now, the budget, because it's a $45 million movie, but not just the budget. All the advertising has been spent on this movie, and the marketing has been spent. You're looking at not just $45 million, but $100 million or more to do this. So they can take that entire thing 2 weeks before the end of the year and write it off on a balance sheet to the negative, so they put it in the fourth quarter loss column. It's the same reason why companies have mass layoffs right before Christmas. As awful as that sounds, they do it for the bottom line, because corporations don't care about people. They're people themselves, legally, but they don't have a conscience and they don't have feelings, so they don't care about people. All they care about is their bottom line. Sony is now able to write this entire thing off, take it as a corporate loss, and throw it into a lawsuit if they ever find out who did this hack. Because if they find out that this Guardians of Peace that claims to have done the hack, if they find out that that was an entity that is not in fact North Korea, or has some sort of actionable area in the States, that's going on that shoulders. And it all gets written off by insurance and taxes. There better be something bigger here than we don't know what's going on behind the scenes. Like some sort of insider knowledge. There's like a possible attack could have happened, but they didn't want to let people know and panic them. And it could very well be this. The government and the White House has been relatively quiet on this. I mean, this is an ongoing story, so gosh knows what happens by Sunday. I just hope that it wasn't one of the country's biggest corporations flinching at a crappy threat at that. That the threat was this broken English, overly blusterous, impossible to execute plan. And there are people saying, well, look what happened in Aurora. Yeah, sure. I went to movies that week afterwards. You can't shut everything down for the possibility that somebody might attack something somewhere. And it's terrifying, but that's the world we live in. Now, the argument I don't like in this one is I've heard people make this argument. They go, well, I hate Seth Rogen and James Franco, and the movie looks like it's going to be crap anyways. Let me make this perfectly clear. The movie's stars and the content and the quality of the film are irrelevant. Just like it's irrelevant if you don't like the people that were victimized by the Sony hack. If you don't like Scott Rudin, it's irrelevant. Because when a crime or an attack happens, it can happen to anybody. And this brings me to my next point. What's going to happen next? Let's not even look in the future. Let's look at what movies are coming out. Is ISIS going to issue a threat against American Sniper? That one opens limited on Christmas Day. It opens wide in January. It's a movie about a sniper who takes out dozens of Islamic fundamentalists and crazy people. What if those people are mad at the betrayal of Muslims in that movie? Are they going to threaten an attack? What if the Japanese or some rogue Japanese group threatens us against the movie Unbroken, which comes out at Christmas? The Angelina Jolie movie, which is about a guy in a Japanese prisoner of war camp, and they're already said they're not happy with their portrayal. What if the KKK issues a threat over the release of Selma, the story of Dr. Martin Luther King marching in Selma? These are real situations. Are we just going to fold on everything? Paramount already folded on Team America, for crying out loud. What if the KKK threatens? That's way more executable in our own country than a North Korean missile attack from halfway around the world. And then what if this happens on a big movie in 2015? What if North Korea thinks the Avengers 2 is about them, that Ultron is somehow an allegory of Kim Jong-un? What if North Korea doesn't like Star Wars The Force Awakens when it comes out? Now, in this case, I think the big studios, they're going to call their bluff, because it's not a $45 million movie. This is a major movie that you can't write off on insurance. But this has set a hugely dangerous precedent, not just for movies coming out, but movies that are going to be made. That's all I have to say about that. When I come back, I'm finally going to review some movies, The Hobbit, Battle of the Five Armies, and Annie. Back Eyes of the Movies with Kevin Carr coming at you. Getting rid of our negative emotion about North Korea and Kim Jong-un and Sony Pictures and The Interview and Paramount Pictures and Team America. Let's talk about some of the films that are out this week so we can actually focus on positive experiences in the movie house, as long as they're good. So let's talk about a couple of the movies. The first one I want to hit on is The Hobbit, Battle of the Five Armies. Now, this is the third of the Hobbit movies, and it actually has been open since Tuesday night, actually, because they, of course, do preview showings, and they did a Hobbit marathon in a lot of theaters that showed the Unexpected Journey and then the Desolation of Smaug, after which they showed the new film, The Battle of the Five Armies. In this conclusion to the J.R.R. Tolkien book, Bilbo Baggins and his dwarf friends must finish off Smaug the dragon and defeat the orcs attacking the mountain.
This was the last move in a master plan. A plan long in the making. Bilbo is right. You cannot see what you have become. Everything I did for them.
When faced with death, what can anyone do?
I have gone on record several times. Obviously, I've talked about the Hobbit films the last 2 years. I like the Hobbit films. I actually like them better than The Lord of the Rings. And I've gone back and rewatched The Lord of the Rings. Now, to be fair, I only have the extended editions on Blu-ray, and those things are long. And I question whether that hour is needed to be put back into any of those three movies. So I do find the Lord of the Rings saga, the complete saga, very plodding. I also find, I think the Two Towers has some interesting color in aspects and palette, as does the Return of the King. The Fellowship of the Ring is actually very muted and gray, and very, which is very common from that era, from about 13, 14, 15 years ago. And that is a bit of a struggle for me to get through. I like the Hobbit movies because they're kind of, I mean, I say lighthearted. I mean, these are heavy movies too. I mean, they're dealing with grand scope and massive battles and death and destruction. But I seem to feel these are a simpler movie, easier to digest, even when you separate it into three parts. Now, with that said, of all three movies, this third one feels the most incomplete. Oddly enough, it also ends the saga. Kind of like how I talked about Mockingjay a couple weeks ago, about how it doesn't feel like a full movie. This one doesn't feel like a full movie, but the point is you can go back and watch the other two. And this one is the ending. This is really just the ending. I mean, it picks up right where Smaug left off, and it's all ending. There's not really any exposition. I mean, there is some, a little bit, but it's mostly just battles and wrapping up the internal Middle-earth politics, which is very interesting. And I think as the three movies together, kind of put together as one nine-hour movie, I think they work. Obviously, I wouldn't go see The Battle of the Five Armies cold with no knowledge of anything. You'd be completely confused. And you'd feel like you were left out because it starts up literally right after Smaug leaves the mountain from the desolation of Smaug. So I like Battle of the Five Armies. I like these movies. I kind of like them better than the Lord of the Rings movies. I've gone back and revisited the Lord of the Rings. Not a whole lot to say. I mean, there's a lot of cool battle sequences. That's the sum total of this movie. It's mostly battle sequences, and it's neat to watch. It's got great special effects, and it's great to see people like even Orlando Bloom, but like Ian McKellen as Gandalf doing his sixth turn as Gandalf and having a blast doing it. So ultimately, I'm going to say that The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies, rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
But I think my favorite of the three actually is, because after I saw this, I went back and watched the first two. Again, I've got those on Blu-ray. I think my favorite is the first one, actually. I think I thought The Unexpected Journey was the best of these three. Although I am looking forward to next year getting this on DVD or Blu-ray and watching all three of them together just to see how they play out. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next film on the docket is Annie. Quvenzhané Wallace and Jamie Foxx headline this modern update of the classic Broadway musical about a poor foster kid who is adopted by a billionaire.
The sun will come out.
Can you read your note again? Please take care of our baby. Her name's Annie. There's half a locket around her neck. So when we come for her, you know that she's our girl.
Will, this is really going to help your race for mayor.
Her name is Annie. She'll be staying with Mr. Stacks for a while.
You want me to play daddy?
It's the hard knock life for us. It's the hard knock life for us.
You're not really thinking about doing this.
We won't even know she's there. It's like having a turtle.
The best thing about this movie is it does not star Willow Smith. I remember when this was first announced, and this was when Will Smith was out there basically starting up movies and putting them into development just so he can have a place to put his kids in acting films. It worked well for him when he helped spearhead The Karate Kid, but it crashed and burned with After Earth, which was a disaster, a terrible movie. This was supposed to be a vehicle for his daughter, Willow. And she just got too old. By the time this thing got off the ground, Willow Smith was into her teens, and they needed another actress. Now, they got Quvenzhané Wallace, and she's best known, and really only known in a lot of ways, for being in Beasts of the Southern Wild when she was real little, because that was several years ago. And I got to say, she's the best thing in this movie. Quvenzhané Wallace is just flipping adorable in this film. She's cute. She can be a little bit smart and sassy, but she is very photogenic. She's got a beautiful voice, and she works in the role. Most importantly, she works as Annie, arguably fitting into the character of Annie even a little bit better than the girl, I forget her name, who played her in the movie back in the 80s. Obviously, very different actresses. But she really carries the film. Outside of Quvenzhané Wallace's acting, there's not a whole lot to look forward to. I mean, I think Rose Byrne's fine in it as the assistant to the Daddy Warbucks character, which is Bill Stax. So bad. Jamie Foxx is okay, but he gets in his own way. He tries to Jamie Foxx it up a little bit too much. He tries to make it like it's like Will Smith doing his Will Smith shtick as opposed to playing a character. And that's where Jamie Foxx falters. And then when he sings like he's making another R&B album. It doesn't fit with the Broadway style. And even though this has been updated and urbanized and made more modern music by Jay-Z and the gang, who are helping to produce this, it really still should be resting on the Broadway tunes. And that's part of the problem. There's several new songs that are added, and they are jarringly different from the Broadway songs. And the problem is, the Broadway songs were great. You know, The Sun Will Come Out Tomorrow and Hark Knock Life, and those songs are in there. There's a couple of them. But it's just achingly clear when they're putting in a new song, because it doesn't sound anything like the other ones. Not even talking about style of music. I'm talking about the meter of it and the flow of the lyrics. And one of my favorite songs, You're Never Fully Dressed Without a Smile, is worked into some terrible cover. And that's really the heart of the problem with this film. They change a bunch of things. And not to be a purist, because I'm not, but every time they make a decision to change something in this movie, it's terrible. They throw in so many pop culture references and so many modern technology and ideas that it becomes almost annoying. It is this nonstop assault of, we've updated this. We're going to talk about Twitter and Katy Perry, and we're going to be talking about Batman, and we're going to be talking about this, and we're going to talk about that. And we have to have all this in there. And it's unnecessary, because part of what the charm of the original Broadway play and then the movie was, it exists out of its own time. Because it's a period piece, it could be seen. You watch the 80s version of Annie, and it feels like it's timeless. This one's going to be locked into 2014, like embarrassingly. Also, Cameron Diaz is terrible in this movie. She is so bad in this movie that it is alarming at times. When it's drawing actually directly from the stage play, it's quite good. And Quvenzhané Wallace really carries this movie. But Jamie Foxx is just okay. Cameron Diaz is absolutely awful in this. And anytime they've changed it for any reason, it's almost embarrassingly bad. So I gotta say that Annie kind of sucks, despite some charm.
It kind of sucks.
Okay. All right, with that, I need to go to a break. When we come back, I'm going to be talking about Night of the Museum, Secret of the Tomb, and the DVD roundup, and some box office. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, calming down finally. Took an entire segment for me to calm down and get to talking about movies instead of movies that aren't coming out. Let's continue to review some films. Let's go lighthearted. I mean, Battle of the Five Armies is heavy, and Annie was lighthearted, I guess. But Night of the Museum, Secret of the Tomb, let's talk about that. The third and final film in the series sees Ben Stiller taking the magic tablet from the Museum of Natural History in New York to London to discover why it is not working correctly.
Now, you and I both know there's something magical in the museum. The sun goes down, tablet starts to glow, and everything comes to life.
There's something wrong with the tablet.
We shall all be dead by sunrise.
Huns don't hyperventilate.
Hello, welcome to the British Museum.
Hi.
Must be wicked being a security guard in America. With your gun, with the silencer, with your ninja swords.
That's not even a little bit true.
Sir Lancelot,
at your service.
Theodore Roosevelt, President of the United States of America.
I have no idea what that means.
This is a series of movies that has been much maligned by a lot of critics. And that's because these movies exist for no other reason than just for silliness. They're fun, complete popcorn kids movies. There's no real redeeming cultural value to it. These are not groundbreaking from a visual effects standpoint, even though they've got some cool things going on. These are not movies that are going to inspire a new generation. They're just fun little cute movies. And you know what? Doggone it. I like them. I like the first one. I like the second one. And I like this one. It's a silly movie. It's a complete whimsical film. And it's got a lot of fun moments. It's got some stupid things happening in it, sure. It's got a monkey running around and peeing on people. That happens. Trust me, I've worked with monkeys, and I'm not just talking about some people I've worked with in radio. I've worked with real monkeys, and real monkeys are mischievous little buggers. So the scene where the monkey's peeing on people multiple times, this is nothing new. There's a reason why if you ever work with monkeys, a lot of times they're in diapers. Again, just like some of the people I've worked with in radio. It's a fun movie. I took my six-year-old. He thought it was a hoot. It's just fun. You've got some really cool special effects. You've got Ben Stiller basically leading a cadre of crazy people. It's got a great cast, too. I mean, Ben Stiller's kind of in his element. This isn't like Meet the Parents, where those have kind of fallen off in quality and stupidity. This is just Ben Stiller playing the straight guy. And he works as a straight man, and he's surrounded by craziness. It also is Robin Williams, one of his final films. And there's a certain bittersweet tenderness to this film because of that. And I don't know whether they re-edited it for this reason or this influenced their editing, but there's a couple moments where that are very, very touching because you know it's Robin Williams' one of his final performances. It's kind of sad to see. You know, I mean, it almost brings a tear to your eye, but it's not done like egregiously or manipulatively. It just, that's what was in the movie. That's what they were filming. And they took full advantage of that, and that's fine. There's also some very funny performance. I mean, the side characters, you've got Steve Coogan and Owen Wilson playing the Roman soldier and the cowboy. And they're there for no reason but for comic relief, and that's fine. It's a cute movie. I enjoyed it. And also, Rebel Wilson's hilarious in this movie. Rebel Wilson is a hoot. I would like to see Rebel Wilson get the exposure and the high-level starring roles that Melissa McCarthy has gotten. Because I think she's just as good as Melissa McCarthy. And I would like to see her do something a little more dramatic. Because most of the stuff I've seen her in has been the outrageous, crazy stuff. You stuff her in, like, Pitch Perfect. And, you know, she's been in a bunch of movies. And she's always playing that crazy version of herself. I think she's a talented actress. I'd like to see her do more. So ultimately, I'm going to say Night at the Museum kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
All right, you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office really quick. The box office winners from last week, I predicted that Exodus Gods and Kings would win. It did. I predicted it would make $35 million. It did not. It made $24 million, which is low. And the 35 was pretty low for this big screen epic that Ridley Scott has done. But the reality is, I mean, let's not mince words. The reality is Ridley Scott, with the exception of a handful of movies, he's never really been a huge director. I mean, he did stuff like Gladiator and Hannibal and Prometheus and, you know, big movies like even Black Hawk Down and Alien back in the day. But you look at his filmography, there's a whole slate of films that are under $50 million that he's made. And some of them were made many years ago, so they cost, you know, that meant more. But stuff like Body of Lies, Matchstick Men, The Counselor, my God, that was a terrible movie. It only made like $17 million. This is kind of on par with what Ridley Scott has done in the past. So I don't think it's a huge disappointment. I mean, I think people were hoping it would be Gladiator level. People were hoping for a $200, $300 million movie. It's not going to get that. Even if it has some decent legs, even if it fends off The Hobbit this weekend and through Christmas and into the new year, it's still got an uphill battle. Now, The Hunger Games: Mockingjay Part 1 dipped finally, and it was finally knocked off the number one, even though it stayed on number one longer than it really should have because there just was no competition, and it's like at $13 million. There are some people, now the big thing people are looking for is, will this overcome Guardians of the Galaxy as a top grossing movie. I think Guardians of the Galaxy is around $336 million or so. And it's still out in theaters, even though it's on DVD and Blu-ray. You can still catch it in theaters. And so it's eking out like $1 million every couple weeks. So that's slowly ratcheting up. And it's whether or not Hunger Games can catch up to it. I personally don't think it will, because this is a front-loaded film. And I think it's going to drop off, especially now that we've got The Hobbit out and you've got Night at the Museum and Annie, and you're fighting now for the family audience. And then, of course, Christmas. There's still, even without The Interview, there's still plenty of movies to check out this Christmas. So then Penguins of Madagascar in top five came in under Penguins of Madagascar with a little under $7 million. And that's still okay. This movie was not an expensive movie to make. You know, I don't know what the budget is off the top of my head, but I think it was like $5 million, $6 million. So it's pretty much already made its money back. And, you know, for an R-rated sort of niche comedy, that's pretty good. And good for Chris Rock that he did something different and successful. Now, this week, we've got definitely The Hobbit's going to win. The Hobbit's going to win the weekend. It's already made like, by the time we're, you know, at the end of next weekend, it's going to probably be well over $200 million overseas. Probably, you know, close to $250 million overseas because it opened a week ago. And it made like $25 million on Wednesday when it opened. So it's going through the weekend with a lot of good nature behind it. I think it's probably good for $60 to $65 million over the weekend. It's going to be probably $90 million or so if you take the 5 day. But still, you know, $60 to $65 million is pretty good. I think that that's what it can make. That's on the high end. And that's on par with the other films, because I think the other films, the other two Hobbit movies, opened on a Friday. So it only had the 3 days, so it had that big push the first day, and it was right around $70 million, I think, for the other two. But it's the final one, and the final installment tends to do better. So I still think this movie's still going to make $1 billion. You know, it's still worth it. They split it into three books, and you can argue till the end of days that it was a bad idea, and I don't disagree with you on that. But at the end, The Hobbit is still going to be one of the top grossing movies worldwide of the year. It'll still be in the top grossing domestics, because there's not a whole lot of them that are, only a couple are going to be over $300 million by the end of the year. You're listening to Fat Guys in the Movies with Kevin Carr, and that sound means it's time to roll into the world-famous DVD Roundup. Handful of movies. We don't have a whole lot of shopping days left till Christmas, so the pickings are starting to get kind of slim. Well, there are a couple that you can check out. There's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which thank God wasn't about, you know, North Korea, or Paramount would have pulled it. And that one, it was better than I thought it would be. If just Megan Fox wasn't in it, I just don't like her. The Maze Runner is out. This one was another teen adaptation I was kind of unimpressed with. I think they're trying to find the next big thing. And if Divergent doesn't pick up like they're hoping, then The Maze Runner is all you've got left at this point. There's Magic in the Moonlight, the Woody Allen film about Colin Firth trying to woo Emma Stone and disprove her psychic abilities at the same time. The Skeleton Twins, which is sadly a kind of a forgotten movie at this point. It came out a little too early to really get too much award buzz, but it was a fantastic performance by Bill Hader. Also a decent performance by Kristen Wiig about a fraternal twin couple who are both dealing with thoughts of suicide and how they sort of work with each other and lean on each other. There's This Is Where I Leave You, which I found to be a much better film than some people. I know. This Is Where I Leave You is that funeral drama with Jason Bateman. It's an ensemble cast. Got like Tina Fey and Adam Driver and Jane Fonda. And it was a lot better than I thought it would be. I was actually kind of impressed. And then on TV, there's not a whole lot. There's The American Season 2, the FX series with Kerry Russell. And then finally, Extent Season 1, about a female astronaut who goes to space and mysteriously returns home pregnant. Yeah, I've heard that one before. All right, the stinger of the week is Peter Pan Live, which was, of course, the Peter Pan production that was broadcast over Thanksgiving. And this looked terrible. I've seen clips from it. It seemed as terrible as The Sound of Music was last year. The only thing is Peter Pan's kind of hot in this movie. Well, that is it for this week. And I guess this is kind of our Christmas episode, because you won't hear me again until after Christmas. But I'm going to keep that rolling just because I want to, because we're going to be talking about the Christmas releases Into the Woods, Unbroken, Big Eyes, and The Interview. I mean, no, sorry. We're not going to be talking about The Interview. Idiots. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.